And the people from the other course will be very surprised. And what is this about? And why do we need to know this? That's their problem. So, English, 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 English. No Hare Krishna today. Very sad day. No. I may fall over because I have never been down the stairs with my glasses on. Right, so one more thing, which is over here. The tanks. Open. And right, so we have a completely new form of literature which appears at this time in England, and it is the periodical essay. Now, I do need the glasses. What is a periodical essay? No, it has a specific meaning in this case. What is a periodical essay in this context? A periodical essay is a piece of non-fiction about culture. And the reason it's called a periodical essay is because it appears in what are called periodicals. Who invented the periodical essay, the ensayo, as you probably would like to call it? An ensayo, or a loosely philosophical essay in the form of a private reflection. Do you know who invented that?
Hume?
No, not Hume. Plutarch. Plutarch in the Moralia. And from the 1580s onwards, Montaigne started to imitate Plutarch's Moralia, and then Francis Bacon started to imitate Montaigne. And one of the earliest collections that we have of these types of essays is Discourses by Way of Essays by Abraham Cowley from 1668. The earliest periodical we have as such is John Dunstan's Athenian Mercury, which was published from 1690 onwards. It is mostly news, but there are some essays in there as well. Who was Dunstan? Who was John Dunstan? John Dunstan was the brother-in-law of a man called Daniel Defoe, who wrote Good. By the way, every year I get one or two pecks which talk about Daniel Defoe. Willem Dafoe is the actor, and a very fine actor he is too, but he has nothing to do with Daniel Defoe, which is with an A. So please don't write Dafoe. It's a very typical mistake in this course, but there is no reason for it. His father was called John Foe. The D was to make him sound slightly more higher class, as sometimes happens in Spain. In 1699, Ned Ward started the London Spy, which began to offer sketches of common people in London and the sights and smells and sounds of the capital. So you begin to get the idea that there is enjoyment in a descriptive situation of an ambiance, etc., etc. Somebody philosophizing, not deep abstract philosophy, but just thinking a little bit about the practical aspects of life. And then from 1704 to 1713, Daniel Defoe wrote single-handedly his review. And his review, although it was mainly about politics and history and a bit of news, also turned into satirize drunkenness, the folly of dueling, the evils of seduction, adultery, and prostitution, civil violence, and inhumane magistrates. So, Daniel Defoe is writing about inhumane magistrates at the same time as Alexander Pope is writing about inhumane magistrates in the lines, you haven't learned them yet, okay. But you have to learn them so that you can put them in your essay. Exactly. Good. And the basic idea that Daniel Defoe is promoting in these essays is moderation, humanity, and good behavior. Occasionally, he also writes an article that promotes good literature. So in fact, it's very similar to what Steele and Addison are going to be doing from 1707 onwards. The big difference is that the review, Daniel Defoe's review, is mainly about politics and history. So, we begin to have things that are becoming more and more like periodicals in this period, and we begin to have more and more newspapers in this period. And we also have an explosion of pamphlets. Why?
Cheaper?
Perhaps.
To criticize the social privileges.
Yeah, but you would think that there would be things to criticize before the Civil War, during the Republic, after the restoration of the monarchy, during the reign of James II, which was very unpopular. Why? Now, what happens? Strangely enough, at the end of the Republican period, there is a law which controls publications, a censorship law. And that law lapses in 1690. That law stops coming into effect. It's in effect, for some reason, there's a time limit on it, and it's in effect for 30 years. And then it stops being in effect. And the politicians can't come to an agreement about how to replace it. And so, for completely arbitrary reasons, the fact that the politicians can't decide how to replace it, you have what Voltaire describes as a sort of revolution, where England, Voltaire says that because of this law, the non-existence of this law, England becomes the first modern society. Basically, you have free speech for the next 30 years. You have a situation where there is no law saying that you cannot say this, that, or the other. And so people do. They just produce pamphlets. No, but they can publish freely what they want because there is no law of censorship. And that, the fact there's no law of censorship, not because suddenly the politicians have become hugely enlightened, it's just they can't agree on how to replace the censorship law. And so, you have, to many effects, the first society with free speech in the history of the world. And in fact, in many ways, it's a society which has freer speech than we do now, because you can commit all sorts of libel and slander. You can make things up about people and publish them. And there's no automatic law to redress this. You can only just go and beat them up or something. But you can't sort of take them to court for libel or for slander, because there's no law for that. So people invent terrible things about each other. And we have a situation, for example, where Alexander Pope describes Aeolus Defoe up in the pillory. Now, Daniel Defoe was pilloried for sedition in one moment. Do you understand pillory? Pillory is the only English word that comes directly from Catalan. A pillory is a type of punishment where you are put in standing up in a block with your hands locked in and your head locked in. Probably, yeah. But the word comes from piloria or something like that in Catalan. It's one of the very, very few words that comes directly from Catalan in English. So it's worth remembering. Now, the problem with being pilloried, I mean, that's a bit uncomfortable, okay? But the real problem with being pilloried is twofold. One of the additional punishments is that they would nail your ears to the block, which is a little bit like getting your ears pierced. It's not rather that big of a... The real problem was what people could throw at you. And you had people regularly being blinded and people being... and of course, if you're having things thrown at you, you're trying to do that and you're tearing at your ears. We're a civilized society, I tell you. But, I mean, you have people who were actually killed in the pillory in England. Because of what people were throwing at them. Now, Daniel Defoe was hugely popular, and when he was pilloried, his ears were not nailed to the pillory block, and people threw flower petals at him. Aww. because he was their hero. The government said he was seditious, but the people defended him. And so, Alexander Pope in the Dunciad describes earless Defoe high in the pillory. And Defoe was not earless because he hadn't had his ears ripped off or anything by on the pillory. So Alexander Pope was actually lying, just making it up. And I mean, there's nothing that Defoe could do about this because there's no censorship law, there's no libel law. So there's good sides and bad sides to this. But you go from a situation where by 1712 we now have 12 newspapers in London. And by 1811, a century later, there are 52 newspapers in London. Everybody's reading avidly. And that creates a situation where there's this explosion of pamphlets, this explosion of newspapers, and there's an explosion of periodicals. What other conducive circumstances are there? What other conducive circumstances are there for all these people to be reading desperately? Yeah, the Latin is very sort of slow, and half of it's written in Latin. Coffee houses, tea houses, chocolate houses. Coffee houses, chocolate houses, tea houses. If you spend all day sitting around drinking coffee and tea, you need to read things. Yeah, and you need things to talk about. Okay? So, this is this coffee society, this tea society, the first place that you deliver these things. I mean, a lot of these people would be selling maybe 5,000, 6,000 periodicals or newspapers or pamphlets, but they would actually be read by 60,000, 100,000. Whoa! 60,000. Why are you saying that? Why are you done? Don't do that. Why are you saying that? Go away. Don't know what you want. I hope you're still recording. Go away. But you will have, you know, a large part of the population, maybe 10% of the population of London were reading the Tatler or the Spectator written by Addison and Steele. So, I mean, it's incredibly influential. And obviously, most of the population of London are sort of illiterate beggars and we don't care about. It means that you are getting to the people who matter, the merchants, the bourgeoisie, all those people, to a very, very large proportion of them, 50%, maybe more than 50%, are reading what you're writing. So it's hugely important. And as I said, you know, if we're just drinking gin and drinking, that's how I drink gin, by the way. If you're just drinking beer and drinking gin, then, you know, you should be sing or have a fight or whatever. But if what you're having is coffee and tea and Starbucks, etc., you need to be able to make a polite conversation. Now, there's a big difference between the pamphlets and the periodical essays. Pamphlets are polemic. Pamphlets are written by people of different sides who want to polemicize, who want to make a radical, controversial argument. They tend to be anonymous. Can you think of anybody name a pamphlet? Can anybody name a pamphlet?
That Time.
Yeah, A Modest Proposal, yeah, by Jonathan Smith. It's a pamphlet. That's what it was, a pamphlet. Sixpence pamphlet. A Modest Proposal. Smith wrote lots of them, dozens. Daniel Defoe wrote thousands of pamphlets. But the point of a pamphlet is that you are usually anonymously making a political point, usually some sort of radical political point in some way or the other, and there is still sedition laws. You can, and that was the danger for Jonathan Swift for the Modest Proposal. They wanted to charge the author with sedition against the British state. But as I said, nobody revealed his identity, so that wasn't a problem. The periodical essays have a different idea. And they come from a new idea that's appearing at the beginning of the 17th century. There's a civil war, yeah? And the people who were alive during the civil war are generally still living the civil war. There's a lot of animosity between Whigs and Tories, etc., etc. This may sound familiar. But you get to a point a couple of generations later when you suddenly realize, really, the difference between the political parties is not that huge. It's not like in America where you have, we want a national health system, we want no national health system, and if you don't have money, you die. We want teachers with guns in lessons. We want to control arms. I mean, these are big questions. This is a seriously divided society. In Europe, generally speaking, what we have is a society that accepts birth control, accepts limited abortion, accepts gun control, accepts national health, accepts public education. Yeah? And we all agree about that. We may disagree a little bit about what you spend on each thing. But if you see the debates in the British Parliament and the Spanish Parliament, etc., you'd think these people were talking about gun control or arms in schools, or, you know, sort of big differences. They do have tiny little differences. They're acting, basically. Yeah? They are overplaying the differences between the two sides because they want to win elections. And really, England has got to that situation. Very soon Britain, or just at the Britain bit, has got to that situation by the beginning of the 17th century. Obviously, trade is a good thing. Yeah? The only people who are questioning being carnivores, eating meat, the only people who are questioning slavery are the nonconformists. Yeah? The only people who are calling for women's education are the nonconformists. There is a broad agreement amongst people in society that we need a banking system, we need a legal system, blah, 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 blah. You may think this lot are more corrupt than that lot, whatever, but There are broad agreements about society. And so people begin to appear, first who want to read things that are not partisan. You don't want every single thing that you do, everything thing you see, to be partisan. That if you're going to be, when the equivalent of watching the news, and you either have to watch pro-government news or anti-government news. Yeah? People want the BBC, as it were. Yeah? They want something which is independent of both and is not trying to sell you something. Is doing its best to create independent news, independent comment. And commercially, Addison and Steele also realise, and various other people, that this is a far better idea. Why? Yeah, but the idea of not being partisan. If I write something that's clearly pro-Pepe or clearly pro-Pessoa or whatever, then I am losing half my audience immediately. If I make a television program, for example, that it is impossible to know what the political leanings are of the person who's presenting the program, because it's a program about culture, and there's just no reference to politics. Potentially, I can have the whole population, not just 50% of the population. It's a no-brainer. Yeah? And that's what these people begin to work out as well. That, what is necessary is something that promotes bourgeois society, something that promotes middle class values, people being vaguely cultured, having cultural things that they can talk about, determining what poets you should have read, what plays you should have read. Now, if you're a business person or somebody like that, you're not going to have a compendium of the whole of English literature up until that point. But you don't necessarily have to know all 400 plays that were written in the Renaissance. You do probably need to be able to say something about 6 plays by Shakespeare and 3 plays by Johnson and a couple of plays by Webster, for example. You do need to have a vague notion about what Paradise Lost, what happens in Paradise Lost. You don't necessarily want to have read the whole thing. Nobody does. But you want some idea about Paradise Lost. You want to be able to say, yeah, Milton's a great writer. Woof, well, go for Milton. So you begin also, there is the idea of a canon, a basic greatest hits of English literature that anybody who considers himself civilized should know. And that concept, in fact, was largely true until my childhood, really. I mean, you can now get somebody like Donald Trump in America who could be proud of his ignorance, who can be proud that he has never read a book in his adult life. That's still in Britain, that's sort of marginal. I mean, but you begin to have sort of footballer celebrities and people like that. But even so, I mean, if the typical footballer celebrity wants to become an actor, then they're going to need to have a little bit of education. I mean, remember that in Spain, your actors and your comedians tend to, I mean, they may be funny, they may be good actors, I'm not talking about that, but they tend to come from the middle or the lower parts of society. Most of the famous actors that you know of, British actors, are from Oxford and Cambridge. Almost all the comedians were from Oxford and Cambridge. If you, somebody like, Mr. Bean, yeah, Rowan Atkinson studied chemistry at Cambridge. All of the people from, Monty Python were studying, most of them were from Oxford, some of them were from Cambridge. People like, you can go on like that. That is, they tend to be intellectuals, our comics, and a lot of our actors. And even, I mean, you have weird situations. Have you seen The Good Doctor? Have you heard of The Good Doctor? Yeah? Well, that actor, I've forgotten his name, he has a matricula d'honneur in theology from Cambridge. Yeah, the actor. And again, I mean, this is another huge difference between America and Britain. America's actors, in many cases, are from the lumpen. You have people who, I mean, like, for example, River Phoenix and Joaquin Phoenix, their family lived in a trailer, and people decide, I am going to make my son or my daughter into an actor, and they're going to start having acting classes at the age of 4, and they, you know, if you're lucky, they become child actors. By 16, they're taking cocaine, and by the age of 20, some of them are dead. Yeah? Which is, again, completely the opposite situation with the situation in Britain. They're often going to very good schools. The idea is that they have to continue an education while they're acting, because it's a European country, education is compulsory, so you have to prove that they are continuing to be educated. In America, because you can be home educated, you can say, I'm educating him to be an actor. He fails to be an actor, or he doesn't look right, by the time he's 20, he has no life. I mean, the American system is absolute crazy for human beings. So we have that sort of difference. That is very much what's happening here. I mentioned in the last class, I mentioned Joseph Fiennes and Ralph Fiennes. Their family came to England with William the Conqueror. They are a hugely established family from the British aristocracy, etc., etc. Those are the sort of people who become actors. They become actors through the theatre. Unlike the Americans. Some of the Americans do theatre afterwards, but it's very strange to become a film actor through the theatre. So the whole concept is different there. But the important thing is that you have to have, getting back to where I started, you have to have this level of, a minimal level of culture. I have spoken to Spanish business people I've talked to, and they've said that, you know, in the over lunch, in a business context, people talk about work or they talk about football. I don't know the situation in Britain now. It may be turning a little bit more towards that, but until that, you would have to be able to say a little bit about culture. It would not be acceptable to know only about work and about football. There is a certain amount of difference there. And these people have money. This newly emerging class has money, but as I have labored, I've said again and again, they are culturally a little bit insecure. So they are desperate to have that information about what they need to know, what they need to have seen, what they need to have read, how they can demonstrate that they are not tradespeople, they are bourgeoisie, they are a true middle class. And so people who are writing about, Steele was a huge fan of Shakespeare. Steele was probably the first person to suggest that Shakespeare was completely different from all the other people. And during the rest of the 17th century, most people thought that Jonson was probably a better playwright than Shakespeare. Shakespeare was fun. Dryden, for example, said that Shakespeare broke the rules, but he was a good enough playwright to be able to break the rules, etc. But the process of turning Shakespeare from being one of the best playwrights of the Renaissance to being Shakespeare is 18th century. And it only really becomes a situation where you have Shakespeare and everybody else from the 1770s onwards. He was successful. He was considered a crowd pleaser. He was considered somebody who would be writing something which was less cultured and more popular. So he's writing Modern Family. He's not writing The Wire. Yeah. Or he's writing, for them, he's writing Game of Thrones. He's not writing, I don't know, something sophisticated, popular, Breaking Bad. I don't know. Yeah. Now, obviously, for us, it's going, how could they see things in those terms? But because Johnson's respecting the classical rules much more, as you will see, as they have seen, Johnson was sort of considered further up. By this stage, we're beginning to have a situation where people say English culture is as good as anything before it. And so somebody who is reinventing the rules for the English language is not necessarily worse for that. In fact, they are better for that. And Shakespeare begins, for example, with very strict iambic pentameters, but by the time he's writing Coriolanus or The Tempest or things like that, it's much more fluid, it's much more natural language, and it's much better poetry for it. So there's all of that. But I mean, while you have a situation where you have the idea that the classical period was, you know, that Ovid and Horace and all of these people were real culture, and everybody after that has been trying to get to that level, then, you know, whoever is closest to that, which in this case is Johnson, is better than Shakespeare. Blah, 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 blah. So, we have this situation where Steele is, with the help of Addison, is given a position in government where he is seeing the foreign dispatches before other people. So, he is seeing what will be the foreign news. The Sultan of Turkey has died. The French have had another revolution. Steele. We're talking here about Steele and Addison. And so he is in a situation where he is seeing what's going to be news before anybody else because he's in the government. And so, in a way which is wonderfully innocent and would, for us today, would seem scandalous, but at the time it was fine, he decides to start a newspaper because he can have exclusives because he has access to government information. Now, you know, for us today that's scandalous, but fine. Whatever. And so he starts the Tatler. And the Tatler appears three times a week on, I think it's Tuesday, Thursday and Saturday. Why Tuesday, Thursday and Saturday? Tuesday, Thursday and Saturday are the days that the post leaves London. Okay, there is a daily postal service within London, but there is the post leaves London and goes around the country only 3 days a week, basically every other day. Okay, so you want to be able to produce this and it's fresh and it's new to make the post so that people could be posted to people living in Oxford and Cambridge and other places around here. That happens. But there is soon you get another newspaper called the London Gazette that's doing the same thing, appearing three times a week, and little by little Steele, with a bit of help from Addison, realizes that what he enjoys about what he's writing and what most people seem to be enjoying is much more the culture section, rather than the news. Yeah? There are other people now producing news, you have newspapers, etc., etc., but this idea that you're producing, yeah, because, yeah, the fact that the King of Spain is ill or something like that is, for people who, the merchants themselves, travel very relatively little. Curious, maybe, but it's not actually that important. But the fact that this play is good, or this play that's on in Drury Lane, you really should see that it's Shakespeare, and Shakespeare is important. That type of thing is more important. Or there's a new coffee house, blah blah blah. And so that by the later stages of the Tatler. It is almost devoid of news. There's almost no news at all, and it is opinion and sketches and character descriptions, etc., etc. And there's quite a heavy doses of satire here. But this is not pamphleteering. So you criticize the folly, you don't criticize the fool. If they talk about somebody, they either say a certain gentleman, or they give some initials, but they don't name names. Yeah? So this is not about, this is not the Sun or the News of the World or this type of thing, with scandals and saying the name of the person and trying to embarrass people and all that sort of thing. It's much more about criticizing bad behavior, but not the person themselves. So again, we are talking about what type of satire? Horatian satire. Okay, it's relatively light, it's good humor. In the final months of the Tatler, Steele begins to introduce more elements of, with a political slant. Steele has been a member of the Whig government and is in fact, in his free time, is a sort of spy propagandist for the Whigs. And one of the, well, we'll talk about that in a bit later. But there is the idea, at the end of the period of the Tatler, there's a bit more politics and a bit more party political politics, and people don't like that. So that's one of the reasons why the Tatler stops. What we have here, we have three names, yeah? We have the Tatler, the Spectator, and the Guardian. And the reality is that you have collaboration between, although Steele is the predominant person in all three, you have collaboration of Steele and Addison in the first two, and a little bit of Addison in the third. And they, in the time sense, they're a continuum. They're just as, whatever it is, I don't know, 8 years of continuous production. But they are divided into these three names. One of the reasons here is to break away from this, the political bias that there is in the Tatler. And the other thing is that they tend to have fictional names of characters in them. And so you will, to be describing a type of figure in London, a type of person, you will invent a name. You will invent a name like Sir Isaac Bitterstick or something like that, yeah? And you will talk about Sir Isaac and you will talk about his family in the countryside who are a bit simple and you will talk about this and the other and you will create personalities and create families and create characters and you also have these descriptions of the city, you will have these invented characters in situations. And once you get to the end of a particular group of people, set of characters, what they do is they stop the newspaper, they change the name. And so from being the Tatler, it becomes a Spectator and you have new characters. So in one sense, because of the people involved, we're talking about exactly the same publication, but the name changes are because there are slight changes in content and changes in the names of characters that are created in them. So, the Tatler is 2/3 Steele and 1/6 Addison. The Spectator is more 50-50. Is there any other difference between the Tatler and the Spectator? With the Spectator, Steele had the crazy idea of producing it daily. So instead of coming out 3 times a week, it comes out 6 days a week. So it's double the work, if you like. And from the beginning, the Spectator takes up the better aspects of the Tatler project. And it is explicitly about healing the political differences between Whigs and Tories, between Puritans and Papists. Now, the fact is that you can have people like Swift, who are members of the Anglican hierarchy, who have Catholic friends like Alexander Pope. You can have people like Swift who are in contact with Whigs like Addison. And people like Addison can have friends who are Puritans, friends who are from the non-conformist Protestant, the people, Protestants who are outside the Anglican Church. So in fact, there is a single society. There are tendencies, but the reality of the newer situation that's emerging is that if people practice their religion privately, in public, everyone can get on. Your neighbour could be Jewish, your neighbour could be Catholic, your neighbour could be Protestant, your neighbour could be Anglican, your neighbour could be whatever, and you don't find out for months on end. Friends of mine at university, it took me maybe 6 months to find out if they were Catholics or not, their family or whatever, just because it's something you just don't talk about. It's private. It's not disgraceful. Yeah. And that's, again, that is the huge... Not so much politics, but also it is the most irreligious country in the world. Or, I mean, I don't know, maybe one or two small countries, but in terms of sort of large countries. And that, again, as I've said before, is our huge difference with America. The American religion is out there. Even the biggest single religion now in the United States, the biggest single religious group in the United States for the first time ever, is no religion. It's atheists. But there is a huge, silent, slow change in America, actually, towards being a less religious society. But as that happens, the people who are religious get louder and louder and louder. But that's another question. So, you have this situation where there is public behaviour which is not about ranting about one side or the other. And, I mean, and again, there are parts of Spanish society where everything is viewed through the prism of politics. And politics has its place, and democracy, of course, has its place, he says, somebody who's been almost completely disenfranchised. I won't be able to vote in Europe, I can't vote in Britain, I can't vote in the national elections in Spain, I can't vote for the Community of Madrid, I can only vote for Carmena. So that's all that's left for me. It's terrible. So Brexit is a complete disaster for people like me. I'm disenfranchised. It's terrible. Anyway, I don't know. I don't know what the situation is. And the worst thing is that they don't know what the situation is. And the only thing that is important, but the only thing important in a modern capitalist economy is predictability. It's that you know what's going to be happening in a few months' time. That is all that society asks of government. And the British government have done things so badly that we know nothing about what is going to happen. I imagine my situation will be exactly the same because I'm married. I am arraigado, etc., etc. I am empadronado for 30 years. No. No, not Spanish. No, it's not immediate. I could apply for it, and I would probably get it. But my problem is that I have a New Zealand passport as well as a British passport, and you're not allowed to have three. And I like having a New Zealand passport. Yeah. So, no, if it gets nasty, I will give up my British passport, because I'm really pissed off with that. But my present situation, which is being... officially here, legally here, paying taxes here, etc. But having a British New Zealand passport is my ideal situation. I'm happy as things were. They didn't have to touch anything. But it is such a mess. It's appalling. I mean, really. And they can't have another vote because there would be a civil war or something. I mean, there is so much animosity now. But if they had a second vote, it would just be horrendous. Probably if there was a second vote, Stay would win. It would reverse the situation. But, you know, really, really, really stupid people in charge. So, you have this creation of a situation where people, and again, I mean, this is absolutely typical of a business type of situation. If you're in business, you're just not interested in the religion or the politics of the people you're doing business with. You want to make money. Naturally, that's what you do to make in business. And you're not going to be asking questions about these things. It's much easier if you don't know. And so for this bourgeois society, this new type of situation makes sense, where you just don't want to know about people's religion. If you find out eventually, you find out eventually, but that doesn't matter. This is people identifying a product and identifying the right product in the right moment. And it is massively successful. So they create a text that is beyond ideology and encourages people to criticize corruption wherever it is seen. So, whereas on some occasions in the past in Spain you've had the idea of si es corrupto presume de los nuestros, so es nuestro corrupto, that attitude is attacked in the new periodical essays. There is previously on a situation of the Whigs being corrupt and the Tories being corrupt, but at least our corruption is for us or whatever, blah, blah, blah. No. In a civilized society, we should attack all types of corruption, is the type of argument. And so the whole concept is to promote civilized life. And often that has a cumulative impact because they will be returning to subjects. I mean, having written the magazine, I can very much identify with this because you have a subject that interests you in a particular period of time, and so you will revisit it, if not in consecutive issues, but in the same year several times, because you don't have lots of isolated interests. Interests tend to flow together, and that will have a cumulative effect. So maybe they will be talking about some good point of Milton, and then some other aspect of Milton, and some other aspect of Milton in a short period of a couple of months, maybe. And that, of course, reinforces itself, etc., etc. So whatever that is, those things tend to happen together. At the same time, where there is any type of moralizing, and the moralizing tends to take the form of satire, which is the most entertaining type of moralizing, but where there is moralizing, it tends to be moderate. So there is the idea that drunkenness is bad, but the theatre is perfectly acceptable. Now, the sort of Puritan position is, oh, theatre terrible, oh, theatre corruption, blah, 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 as we have seen. But it's taking a moral position, but not taking it to ridiculous extremes. Gambling is bad. And where possible, things that are follies, that are more idiotesque than sins, as it were, are laughed at more than attacked. So there's a criticizing, but a joking criticism of practical jokes, bromas pesadas, of swearing, of vulgar colloquialisms, of coquetry, of pose, of dandies and people like that, of frivolity in social ladies, of affected dress, of excessive fashion, of dandyism, of pedantry, of swashbuckling, of commercial meanness, and of narrow-mindedness. But those are the things that they tend to laugh at, and they only attack things which are much more serious sins, like have a good weekend, like gambling, like seduction, like dueling, like hooliganism, and like cruelty to animals, and people. Again, that aspect of English society, that aspect of English society about cruelty to animals, etc., goes back a long, long, long way. And again, that being part of bourgeois values, what people used to say in Spain, well, whenever if you mentioned bullfighting or whatever, I try not to, but it would be, oh, yeah, fox hunting, etc. But fox hunting is aristocratic, or was aristocratic. It is to do with the aristocracy in the countryside, and completely something that was always completely rejected as an urban practice. Obviously, you don't do it in the cities, but by the urban population. So you have a little bit like our friend Henry Howard. Do you remember Henry Howard?
Long time ago.
He used to go around firing stones with a catapult through Protestants' windows, yes? There is a certain tendency for people like David Cameron and Boris Johnson and people like that, in that when they're young, to be hooligans, to be upper-class hooligans. And as I say, this has continued until recent times in places like Oxford and Cambridge a little bit. At this time, there was a group called the Mohawks, who actually our friend John Gay wrote a play about them. And the reason they were called the Mohawks is because there's a group of Mohicans, a group of Mohicanos, literally the Native Americans, came to visit Britain, and these young aristocrats decided they were going to imitate them. I don't know if they had punk haircuts or not. They went around doing vandalism, pretending to be North American Indians. Of course, a complete racial slur, completely unacceptable in that sense, but of course the Americans were still doing it in the Boston Tea Party. When they went to attack British tea on the ships, they dressed up as Indians to do it, to try and hide their identity. So, anyway, you have a difference between what is censorable in terms of people shouldn't really do it and what is bad. Seducing young women and ruining their possibilities is evil, as should be attacked. Mistreating dogs and even mistreating children is bad. But gambling is bad. You can ruin your family. But things like being a dandy are just something, things that should be just laughed at. One of the reasons that dueling was something that was so criticized was that steel, without really having been involved at all, had got involved in a duel when he was young. He had been a captain in the military. He hadn't provoked this situation, but he'd been forced into this situation. And he had wounded the other person, a man called Captain Kelly, and almost killed him. And this made him so anti-dueling that he regularly, in the publication, attacked dueling. And of course, dueling really goes back to pre-modern justice. Yeah? It's sort of a type of divine justice. God will allow the person who is right to win, etc., etc. And so is antithetical to ideas about modern bourgeois society. In modern bourgeois society, you go to court and you don't settle it between yourselves with swords or with pistols or whatever. So the type of person who's being promoted is completely different from the type of person being promoted by the Restoration Society. It's somebody who believes, it's a gentleman who believes in reason and control, who values correct opinion more highly than anarchic wit, who is less ready to call a spade, somebody who is diplomatic in their language. He is civic-minded, he is moderate, and he is Christian. Instead of being aristocratic, libertine, and skeptical. So some of the aristocrats at this time are forming things like the Hellfire Club, where they basically pretend to be Satanists, and they do sort of crazy Satanist things in places like High Wycombe, which is a really strange place to do Satanist things. If you know High Wycombe, you don't know High Wycombe, so don't worry. Basically, if you're rich and aristocratic, you're almost expected to go through a crazy phase. Now, the best place to do the crazy phase is where? Europe. You go on the Grand Tour. You go on a grand tour, accompanied by somebody who's meant to be a reasonably civilized influence, or somebody who will pay to get you out of prison because you've been arrested because you were drunk. You go on the grand tour with a bear keeper. Yeah? Un guarda osos is what they called the middle class person who would accompany the young aristocrat to Europe. Now the idea is, in theory, is that they become cultured. So they see the art in Paris, they see the art in Rome, they see the art in Venice, they learn to read Dante in the original Italian. The reality is that they get all the craziness out of their systems, they get lots of young European girls pregnant, etc., etc., do that a long way away from home, and then they can come back, calm down, etc. And we still have the same principle with our hooligans. Yeah.
In a way, it's like, just like,
exactly. Yeah, well, I mean, the attitude that, to some extent, people will do things in continental Europe that they won't do at home is true. I mean, the attitude sort of the government is, instead of saying, if somebody is arrested in football violence or whatever, the attitude of the British government for some time now has been, punish them as hard as you like, not, yes, but think that they're British citizens, be nice to them. If you're in that type of situation of public violence, British government's attitude, and I know people in the embassy, so I know that it is the case, is do what you like to them, really, you know, in Europe, not in Turkey, but in Europe, not in Egypt, but in Europe, apply your laws as you like. But yes, I mean, there is a little bit of that. I mean, again, the problem, the perennial problem with the British is one attitude if you're drinking tea and coffee, another attitude if you're drinking alcohol. And those two completely different situations are how you can have London at 5 o'clock in the evening, and there's one, excuse me, and London at 12 o'clock at night, where you're sort of trying not to bump into people who can't walk straight. So yeah, strange country. Blah, 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 blah. So, virtue is considered natural, and it is associated with self-respect and intelligence. Yeah? People who are basically intelligent, people who have a little bit of dignity, they're going to be virtuous. Getting drunk, gambling, womanizing, all these types of things are just behavior of people who are immature and a little bit stupid. Fascinatingly, Steele is probably the first person in English writing of any sort who really respects women, who really thinks that women are a civilizing influence in society, that women can save English society in a certain sense from itself. He is hugely respectful of women, and he respects them for their intelligence, for their virtuosity, not just in the sort of in the physical sense that you would get from the Restoration. It's a completely new set of values in that sense. Blah, 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 blah. Sorry? Yes, generally. I mean, for example, he's harder, I would say, on the men in The Rape of the Lock than he is on women. But, yes, he can. I mean, he can be cynical about all sorts of people. He can be satirical about all sorts of people. And in a lot of cases, women are in a worse position to fight back than men are. Certainly, Pope and Swift and, especially Pope and Swift, it would be much easier to say that there was a bit of a misogynist side to their characters. Again, Pope and Swift is just, I mean, they can be very light and Horatian, but there are situations where they get indignant and they will go for somebody. And we're talking about people who are very intelligent, who, when they really feel that they want to go for somebody, they will destroy them. And so it's more a case of that than being hard. I mean, not, they're not harder on women than they are on men. Yeah. But I mean, but much less so with the Whig writers who are going to say, Addison and Steele are pro-women. They're pro, and Defoe is very, very much pro-women. He's about allowing women into many more professions. He's about saying it's vitally important that we increase women's education. And Addison and Steele say it's vitally important that women receive more education. They're perfectly capable of receiving more education. And, I mean, and again, some of that is commercial sensibleness. A significant part of their readership is women. We're now not talking about a society like Shakespeare's society where there's a big difference between men and women in terms of who can read. There's a class difference. Generally speaking, the lower class is the working class. If they can read, they can read in a sort of functional sense. They just don't have time to read for entertainment. But most of the middle class, most of the bourgeoisie, both the men and the women can read by this stage. And so a significant part of the readership are women. Cater for them. Yeah? Why not? Why? There's no reason. There's no need for misogyny as part of that value system. It's not like Donald Trump, where misogyny is part of his racist 1950s mindset in general. So it's natural for him. It's not natural for these people to be misogynist, so there's no reason for it to happen. In the case of, which way around is it? I can't remember which it is. Well, I'm going to pretend that, I'm going to be confident. Addison was happily married all of his life, etc., etc. I think Steele didn't marry, or perhaps the other way around. But anyway, they very much believe in marriage and not believe and don't believe in womanizing and this type of thing. And that is what they do in their lives as well. Steele is a very young man, drunk a bit too much, it has to be said. But apart from that, I mean, these people are reasonably, they're not talking about having ridiculously strict moral rules. They're talking about sensible moral rules. They're things that we can still recognize. And they're livable values. They're not sort of crazy sort of things where you say, because I want to be a priest, I'm going to be celibate, when, you know, that is a completely against nature and half the people can't live up to it. It's saying, I don't think you should mistreat animals because there's no need to. I'm not going to gamble because it's stupid. Gamblers always end up losing. I'm not going to get excessively drunk because that's not, you make a fool of yourself. No, it's just reasonableness. Blah, blah, blah. How are we doing? 8:16. Right. So, we have a type of writing which has to be done relatively quickly because they're writing by the stage of the spectator, they're writing daily. You have to bash the thing out. So, it's writing which is relatively simple, it's writing which is clear, and it is relatively short. So, from a situation where, you know, you're meant to be writing in iambic pentameters and you're being clever like Pope, fine, that's good for Pope. Pope has all the time in the world. You have a situation where clear, colloquial English, which is well written, where you read it once and you understand it, is valued. And that becomes a new value in English literature. And there are texts which are relatively short. Now, we have a bit of a problem with the Tatler Guardian Spectator, which should say Tatler Spectator, with these magazines, which is that generally speaking, while they existed, they were viciously attacked by the Tories. Basically, the Tories could not believe that the Whig propagandist Steele was involved in something which was apolitical. And so they just assumed that somewhere between the lines it must be Whig propaganda. And it was only really after the disappearance of the spectator, and by the time that he was on the Guardian stage, that a number of Tories began to respect this tradition of the periodical essay. And indeed, you have a situation where Pope and Gay, among other people, contributed to the Guardian, actually wrote a few articles in the Guardian. Steele was incredibly famous because he had been expelled from the House of Commons. It didn't happen very often, because he had supported the succession of Georg von Hanover in the last years of Queen Anne. And this was, Queen Anne was very, very much against this. And when eventually Georg von Hanover was invited over to become George the First, Steele was knighted because of his support under the reign of Queen Anne. So he was one of the most famous people in relation to the new regime. Now the new regime is George the First, the Hanoverian dynasty, there was an Anne. Okay. And nothing. We changed from the Stuarts basically having a Whig government having a Tory government to having the Whigs in power for the rest of George the First, and I think the rest of George the Second, in fact. So we have a long, long period of the Whigs being in power, which is one of the reasons why the Tory writers that we've seen are so unhappy. It's a little bit like if you imagine a political party who thinks that they are the natural party of government being in the opposition. Those people feel incredibly offended by the fact that they're in the opposition. I'm not talking about the popular party. So, blah, 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 blah. So only in that final stage do you have people like Gay and people like Pope actually participating in what, until that point, they had assumed was a Whig publication. And it has to be said that Steele does not do himself any favours. When he ends The Guardian, his next publication is The Englishman, which is polemically pro-Whig. So having, you know, finally created a space where everybody can come together and talk about culture, he destroys that space and goes back to writing a Whig publication, which doesn't continue the tradition of the periodical essays. So the foundation of the periodical essays, even though Steele continues writing The Englishman afterwards, stops, as we understand it, with the end of The Guardian. Okay? So, blah, 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 blah. By the end of the process, we have this form that has been defined, and other people continue writing periodicals for most of the rest of the century. Periodical essays essays in periodicals are the only literary form that all of the great writers at this time partake in. We have essays, periodical essays written by Steele, by Swift, by Pope, by Gay, by Fielding, by Samuel Johnson, by Boswell, by Cooper, and by Goldsmith. Everybody dabbles in periodical essays. This is the point where everybody comes together. Whether they are primarily novelists, whether they are primarily playwrights, whether they are primarily poets, everybody writes a bit of periodical essay. Not only that, this form is absolutely vital for the appearance of the novel, the modern novel. Okay? The novel, as we will see, is something that the very first bits of more or less realistic prose narrative appear in Egypt and medieval China and other places. You have been taught that the first novel is Don Quixote of finance. I'm perfectly happy for you. But you have to, you have to say what are the characteristics of a novel and to what extent are two different moments in different people's literary history fulfill these things. And it is a process. And that process is impossible with the works, or without the works of, Jorge Montemayor, or Cervantes, or elements of the picaresque, but it is also doesn't reach maturity without the early 18th century English novel. So it's a process, and to say this is the first novel, ultimately, with anything, to say Moll Flanders is the first novel is childish. To say Don Quixote is the first novel is childish, because it is a process over several countries, Britain, Spain, France, ancient Egypt, China, whatever, and it is little by little. But what we have from the periodical essays is realistic descriptions of everyday life become important, a huge advance over fantasies. Well, fantasies are about creating a sort of dream environment, and you have to describe enough to be, for people to believe that what's happening is more happening in that dream environment. But the description of how a room is laid out so that you can imagine it perfectly, the sights and smells on the street, this type of thing is something that is incorporated into the novel from the periodical essays. These descriptive things, and also the descriptive episodes of character. That sort of psychological complexity. Obviously, there are elements of developing a psychological image of a Don Quixote, for example, in Don Quixote, but the enjoyment in going directly into their psychology, going into their mind, and imagining the world from somebody else's point of view like that, obviously it's not, it's pre-Freudian and blah, 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 but that concept of trying to create somebody's world experience in the here and now, in this world, in the London street where you can go and visit and follow on a map what Moll Flanders is doing, the places she's visiting, comes again from the periodical essays. The valuing of colloquial language. The fact that language doesn't have to be ornate and full of alliteration, figures of this and other, but should be clear so that you can skim read. And the language, when you have dialogue, should be believable. People don't speak in iambic pentameters, sorry. So write in a way that you couldn't imagine somebody speaking. Again, you have this, the philosophy of the time is in this really convoluted abstract thing, which doesn't square well anyway with English bourgeois values. English philosophy, where there is philosophy, and philosophy is not something the English tend to value very highly, is pragmatics. It's very, very practical philosophy. It's not about weird questions of high abstraction. It's much more concrete. And it's very much adopting the scientific values, the scientific spirit of the age. So, being comprehensible, being clear, being readable, starts to become very important. And there are direct influences on literature. For example, in the Guardian Guardian number 26, Guardian number 26 published an article about Alexander Selkirk. Do you know who Alexander Selkirk was? Alexander Selkirk was a man who spent several years marooned on a desert island in, I think, the Pacific. And Daniel Defoe read this article and wrote Robinson Crusoe on the basis of this real life experience. And he presented it as real life experience. He presented it as biography. Moll Flanders is presented as biography, as real experience. It is meant to be as believable as possible. You have people who are so stupid. So there was an English bishop at the time of Thomas More who was so stupid that he read Utopia, and said, we need to send some diplomats to Utopia to visit this island to establish diplomatic relations. So we said, Thomas More made this up. It's philosophy. But the idea here is to create something that is believable. Now, obviously, it would be very difficult for so many things to happen in somebody's life as happened in North Flanders. It would be difficult for a 70-year-old to remember with this level of detail, unless she'd somehow been keeping a diary or something, but that isn't what we're told. We have a situation here again where Addison laughs at the ridiculousness and extravagance of Italian opera. So he may have had some influence on Gay, who was writing with him and reading these things in The Beggar's Opera. All of these things feed in. So I'm afraid we have to stop. I have to rush over to Guadalajara, exciting Guadalajara. Yes, I have to give a talk tomorrow morning. But it's because it's too early for me, so I don't want to get up in Madrid and have to go to Guadalajara. That would be too much to ask. So, does anybody know any good restaurants in Guadalajara? You've never been to Guadalajara? It's terrible, capital. Es un capital de provincia, no tiene nada, ¿no? Pobrecito. Yes. I go to Alcalá de Henares every week. In 2 weeks. What? Are we going to see more flowers? Of course.
How many classes of
one? A very, very intense one, but one.
I'm determined to bring you.
I hope so.